Доктрина Герасимова или
военная доктрина России
война.
Обсуждалась.
Гибридная война – это уникальная методика по уничтожению.
Нет никакой гибридной войны.
Это так называемая гибридная война.
Hybrid warfare, non-linear warfare, new generation warfare, cross-domain coercion, active measures, reflexive control, and the Герасимов doctrine. There is certainly no shortage of terminology or jargon to describe Russia's military tactics and strategy. And today, we'll try to move beyond the catchphrases and take a closer look at what Russian strategic doctrine, strategy, and capabilities actually are. What is Moscow actually trying to do, and what does this portend? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. is military analyst Michael Kaufman, a fellow at the Wilson Institute's Kennan Institute and a research scientist at the CNA Corporation. Welcome to the podcast, Michael. I've wanted to get you on for a while, and I'm glad we finally made it happen.
Thanks, Brian. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you. And also joining us via Skype from New York City is Johan Nordberg, a senior analyst at the Swedish Defense Research Agency. Welcome, Johan. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Glad to be on here.
Glad to have you. So Michael, let's start with you since it's basically your fault we're doing this topic today. Earlier this month, you wrote what I thought was an outstanding and very informative piece for the War on the Rocks blog titled The Moscow School of Hard Knocks, Key Pillars of Russian Strategy. And I wanted to quote from that piece just to get us rolling, to get the conversation going. In that piece, you wrote, quote, Russia's leadership is pursuing an emergent strategy common to business practice and the preferred path of startups, but not appreciated in the field of security studies. The hallmarks of this approach are fail fast, fail cheap, and adjust. It's principally Darwinian, prizing adaption over a structured strategy. You go on to write that this strategy is lean and iterative. It's about feeling the terrain beneath your feet to figure out the next step toward your goal. Politically and economically, Russia is often a laggard compared to Western Europe, but it is a worthy competitor in international politics with an intuition for seizing advantages. Moscow can fail and try again comfortably within a single U.S. decision-making cycle. That's an interesting way to look at Russian strategy, and one I tend to agree with. Michael, can you unpack this for us and explain how this has played out in various theaters?
Yeah, sure. So emergent strategy or lean strategy is something that, as I said, startups do it, but also really big infrastructure-sized businesses sometimes try this too. And that's why, you know, sort of a large power like Russia could be successful with it. And this is all about speed, agility, quick cycles, trying things that don't work, and then adapting to get to your goals. You know, and the best way to think about it is how do they succeed with this, right? In my article, I try to identify what are the conditions they set up to make this emergent strategy work, right? Best way to think about it is Russia basically buys time for itself in these conflicts to make mistakes while the United States is busy trying to figure out what to do. And it carves out the conflict as its own sandbox to use power at will, be it in eastern Ukraine or in western Syria. They're very good at managing Western decision-making into a predictable or formulaic interaction, meaning they set things up so that we will make certain decisions when we react to them. It buys them the space and the time to achieve political goals, right? So part one of that.
So that's reflexive control is what I'm hearing here. That's that
well,
part of it.
Right. But, you know, I'll tell you something about reflexive control is, reflexive control is it basically a Soviet operationalizing approach of, you know, 2,000-year-old Sun Tzu principles of I'd like to win without fighting. How can I win without having to use any military force? And, you know, I think reflexive control is probably the hybrid warfare of its time. Some Soviet colonel made a career writing about it back then. But, yeah, essentially I think you're right in that regard.
Setting the environment.
So the first part of this is really about deception, cognitive bias, right? Like in Crimea, for example. They played a very good deceptive game, making the United States think they were after lesser goals. And we thought they wanted a way out, maybe just get autonomy for Crimea or frozen conflict. But they were just very quickly buying themselves a couple weeks' time to seize the peninsula. Another big part of it is, you know, convincing the United States Russia's escalation dominance. In some cases, it does. But they're very good at showing resolve, establishing coercive credibility, and that they will pull out the hammer and use it if we contest them in a conflict. And actually, at times, it's been really strange. Like in Ukraine, Many commentators could not do basic math that the Russian military is way too tiny to even occupy a sizable part of Ukraine, right? The numbers never added up for a large Russian invasion in Ukraine. Ukraine's the largest country in Europe. But you remember all these fears about Russia might make a land bridge to Crimea, right?
Mm-hmm.
With what? They have a very pretty small land force. So escalation, dominance, and deception are about managing decision here into a particular corner. Stalls out decision-making, pushes the West into caution, says, look, the risks are high, balance of interest on our side, your losses will be low, just stay out. And they've done this in Syria, too, where they actually didn't have a great hand of cards. They bank on American hubris and sort of religious belief that, you know, the expectation that Russians will fail, right? They basically say, yeah, we will fail. We'll get into a quagmire. Don't contest us. Just stay out. We like the fact that you have a cognitive bias that believes that we should be left alone to use force and fail of our own accord, and then they don't fail. Right.
No, and this is almost profound. I mean, I remember when the whole business in Syria started back and myself and many others on this program and many other programs were saying Russia's going to fail, Russia's going to fail, Russia's going to fail. And guess what? They didn't.
I'll tell you. Well, I think a lot of people were in good company there. And I was hearing a lot of people here in Washington, D.C., in the U.S. government, basically before they even started carrying out strikes, saying, oh, we're sure they'll fail. This will happen. And I said, when did we get so many prescient experts on what's going to happen in the Middle East? And how come we didn't have them when we were intervening there? Mm. Right. How is it you guys are so good now in predicting what will happen from use of force in the Middle East? Because I don't recall the sort of talent, these analytical assets being here in 2000s. But I'll close out by saying the Russian goal in these contests is, look, put the United States into a binary choice. All right. In these situations, either you actively contest what Russia's doing, or you choose to punish them into an international system, right? And the United States sits on top of the international system, so there's a natural bias to leaning towards punishment. And in all cases, we choose to punish them. And the Russians, almost masochistically, say, yeah, punish us, go ahead. And these punishments, they prove to be not coercive. These sanctions, they don't yield coercive results in these particular conflicts, as we can see. And by and large, they carve out the space in the conflict to do what they want to do. They turn it into a sandbox, and they try these different approaches. The messiest one was Ukraine, where they kept trying different things that didn't work. But their goal is bid as cheaply as you can, bid low, escalate when you have to, right, and just maintain flexibility and agility in the conflict.
Now, Johan, turning to you, I mean, you recently contributed to a study of Russian military capabilities over the next 10 years for the Swedish Defense Research Agency. Do you agree with Michael's assessment? It sounds like almost an asymmetrical tactic for a country that knows it has conventional military inferiority vis-a-vis its adversaries. Would you add anything? And is this current strategy sustainable from your perspective?
Yes, I think it's sustainable. I mean, Michael put it very well. You know, it's a lean strategy, try fast, fail fast, etc. It doesn't cost very much. And overall, I will make two points. Using military force works for Russia. It buys you influence in the international system. And also, whatever you call it, hybrid or all these new warfares, Russia has the initiative. The West is in a reactive mode all the time. I boil it down to those two things. Michael is overall right. Strategy is sustainable, yes. On the overall level, putting a lot of society resources into building military power over time, which Russia has done now for the past 10, 15 years, is a matter of political will. Whether that's sustainable with the economy, etc., is a matter of priorities. Well, if you have a defense spending of 5% of GDP, that shows that this is a high priority for you. And what I see when I study the Russian military and what it does at home in terms of exercises, it's not preparing for hybrid warfare or peace operations or something. It's preparing for major interstate conflict. It's about going to war on a big scale with other states. It's about a societal effort of going to war, not just the armed forces fighting an operation.
Well, that's very interesting, because given what Michael just said, it would seem to suggest the opposite. How do these two things fit together?
They do very well, because within the framework of what I describe, Michael's pieces fit very well in. If you prepare for a major interstate war, you have the assets, methods and tools you can take and adapt for smaller operations. Both Donbass and Syria are small operations in scale compared to what the Russian armed forces are practicing to do at home. Uh-huh. Number two, with both operations, especially Syria, it's an operation that hasn't really been touched by any adversary that can affect it in a physical terms. Mm. It's untouched when it comes to the major things like logistics and ILTA. ILTA would be a completely different setup if there was trouble with logistics or more potent air defense on the size of Russia's adversary.
I see Michael wants to jump in here. Michael, do you have something to add here?
Yeah, I have two things. One, so they do fit very well together. You need that high-end conventional capability. You need to have it. You need to train for it. You need to show that you have it in order to engage in what Russia does, which is really purely coercive warfare, okay? How do you deter the West from intervening? How do you threaten your adversaries and compel them into certain decisions, right? You need this high-end capability so that you can actually engage in these low-cost asymmetric approaches, because you can sort of bend them to your will and twist their arm instead of having to break it. You have it, but you don't use it, because if you used it all the time, it'd be really expensive. You'd get stuck in things, kind of the way the United States has in Iraq and Afghanistan. Instead, you use it to leverage things out of your adversaries.
Uh-huh. Now, I also wanted to turn, because we do have some military action this week, so to speak, the escalation in the Donbass run of Avdiivka. I wanted to briefly get both of your takes on this, because there's a lot of debate going on about what's going on here, if this is being driven by Moscow. I certainly have my take on it. I made it clear in the morning vertical, in the daily vertical this morning. Michael, what do you think? Is Moscow the driver of this escalation, and to what ends?
Yeah, all right. It's a little bit hard to tell, because on the one hand, I read different reporting. You got Chris Miller's reporting for RFRL on the ground that painted a very different story, and Andrew Kramer's writing from New York Times as well that made it suggest Moscow was probably not the one responsible for this escalation. On the other hand, we sort of commonly lean towards the assumption that if there is an escalation in Ukraine that's driven by Moscow for some objective. I think that, one, throughout the past 2 years, between both sides, there's a gray zone between their two lines of control. And both sides have occasionally conducted these mini offensives going into the zone between their lines, creeping forward towards the other line, and trying to get into a position where they could strategically overlook and shoot at roads, whatnot. And it's unclear to me who did it this time. This is not the first Avdiivka fight that has erupted because of this. But it's clear that a mini offensive was conducted by one of the sides. The other side retaliated with artillery. But it ended up being a much larger artillery duel than both of them planned for. And so now, today, people are telling me that the artillery shelling is going through the depth of Donetsk, and it's heavier probably than it's been in a year and a half or 2 years. It's pretty bad. The hope is that, because neither side is pulling up forces to actually have a real fight, the hope is that this artillery duel will quickly de-escalate, right? That they're going to keep escalating until they say this is getting crazy and out of hand and we have to do an informal ceasefire again.
I wanted to throw out a couple of data points that kind of inform my thinking on this. And this is strictly a hypothesis at this point. But 2 days before this, now, first of all, I say you're right. These kinds of things happen in the gray zone all the time. They don't always flare up into something like we've seen this week. And that I think, is the key thing to bear in mind. But three data points. 2 days before the escalation, Russia warned the OSCE that there was going to be an escalation. It's almost as if they, you know, knew something. Number one. Number two, if I can believe what I'm reading in Oleg Kashin's column and in some other Russian press reports, journalists from Russian state television were miraculously on the scene like days before this happened, getting ready to film it, which suggests something. And then the kicker was Dmitry Peskov's comments a couple of days back when he said, the re-escalation of the Ukraine conflict just proves the need for Russia and America to get together and solve this. Now, this to me, I immediately thought reflexive control, basically, because this is Russia wants a grand bargain with the U.S. They want a grand bargain that gives them a free hand in Ukraine. And what better way to prove that than that the Minsk process is failing, the Normandy format's failing? Let's get the two big guys in here to solve this, and then they think they can probably get what they want. So this is my thinking right now. I agree. The situation on the ground looks very murky. I almost don't think it matters who fired first. Somebody decided to turn this escalation into a bigger escalation than we've seen in previous incidents in the gray zone. Johan, you want to jump in here, and I want your thoughts on that as well, Michael.
Well, let's not forget the major point that Russia has been the driver of the conflict in Donbass since 2014.
Right. Yes.
understanding the very basic point of who turns up and down today or yesterday. Well, I mean, the main reason is that Russia has an interest of keeping that thing going and keep Ukraine under its under Russia's thumb, and no major foreign policy and security policy decisions will be made in Ukraine as long as this is going on.
Michael, your thoughts?
Well, I agree with Johan, but I would add, listen, we shouldn't sell Ukraine short in one respect, because we often take away agency from Ukraine and make it sound like the Ukrainian leadership doesn't have its own interest, doesn't have a sizable force there at this point, isn't doing its own thing. And what I'd like to say is that I think that in this particular case, after the phone call between Vladimir Putin and Trump, both sides had an interest in figuring out where they actually stood, right? From the Russian perspective, they no doubt wanted to have this exchange and then see what the United States' reaction would be. And if the United States' reaction is muted, which frankly I think it is, right?
Yeah.
It tells them a lot of what they need to hear. They're not looking for the United States to say, listen, we leave Ukraine to you. It's not. They understand Ukraine is not America's to give to them, right? They're just looking for a response of, you're not worried about what's going on here with this escalation? This doesn't bother you? Okay, then we know what we need to know about this.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing for the Ukrainians. I think the Ukrainians in this fight were trying to signal to Washington, saying, listen, you cannot trade us away to Vladimir Putin. We're going to hold this line. We will defend our national interests. We're not like a chip for you to play with us in some kind of larger chessboard. And I can sense that signaling from Kiev as well.
Uh-huh. So both sides would have had an interest in potentially making this flare up. Johan, go ahead.
Yes, but also if you look at this larger chessboard, what can Russia really offer the United States if you can make a grand bargain? You know, they want all of these concessions
from
the U.S.
That's a good damn question.
Mm-hmm.
You basically recognize Crimea, sphere of influence, withdraw NATO forces, et cetera, et cetera. But what can Russia really offer the United States then in this?
And I've pondered that for a while. I've written about it on my blog. I've talked about it in my video blog, and I don't know what Russia is realistically.
I mean, I've heard one Russian concern is that, you know, if Russia can really offer support in fighting ISIS, for example, what the U.S. apparently does not want to do is get involved on the ground in Syria. Is that something Russia could offer? Well, that could be very big and very costly. I don't think they would. But I've heard Russians discussed and sort of fearing that that could be on the table. I don't think it would be, but
nor do I.
I can't see any other things, really.
No, when I look at all the things that are out there, I mean, cooperation fighting ISIS, isn't it in Russia's interests, independent of everything, to be fighting ISIS? Of course it is. A nuclear arms deal, that one is the strangest one I ever heard, because those things are usually negotiated on their own merits in both sides' interests and without linkage. The only thing I could come up with is that Russia would stop its political meddling in the West in exchange for a sphere of influence in the former Soviet Union, which is essentially extortion. That's not a grand bargain. That's extortion.
But would they stop?
I don't think so. I think because giving into extortion only invites more extortion. Michael?
Yeah, I think Boulder, you're absolutely right. The toughest challenge for Russia is basically what's on this half of the bargain that we really need. And I agree with the overall sort of wisdom that there isn't much they can really offer us. The only thing I would caution you is, you know, in my writing, I regularly chide the policy establishment on conventional wisdom. And, like, I hate it when I hear consensus. Whenever I hear consensus, I begin to hear echo chamber, and it worries me.
This is why I read you.
Particularly when it comes to the Russians. And so one thing is, we should be careful not to assume that our enemies and our allies going through these coming years will be the same ones we've had before. And I think the Russians are sitting back saying, we don't know what cards we have to play with the United States because we don't know who they're going to make an enemy and who they're going to try to make an ally. So maybe we will have something to play down the line, depending on their policy interests. The problem for the Russians is that whenever the relationship switches to a positive agenda, okay, they quickly run out of steam because they actually don't have any concrete positive ideas on any sort of positive agenda on what they want, what they would like to get out of the relationship with the United States. The U.S. always has a checklist. It comes to them with a checklist of things we want to do. We get those things out of them. And they themselves have like these nebulous ideas of, I want a sphere of influence. I want to be in some kind of security framework in Europe. But it never materialized into anything. So I think probably what the United States could get out of them is basically end Russia's, you know, overall rebellion within the international system against this United States-led order, right? Would they be willing to stop political meddling in Europe? I doubt it. Would they be willing to end the sort of wider rebellion? Perhaps. It's debatable. But I don't know if that's how the United States really defines its interests.
Well, I mean, on this program a couple of weeks back, Vladimir Frolov made the point that basically Russia wants a transition from an international order based on rules to one based on deals, basically. Now, what does that mean in practice? That means a free hand in the former Soviet neighborhood, imperial domination over its neighbors, if you will. I mean, that's essentially, I think, what they want. Do you think that is the strategic goal of all this stuff, all this, everything we're talking about here, the hybrid war, the reflexive control, the political meddling and everything they're doing? Is that the end game?
Yeah, I mean, I'd have a slightly more nuanced view, I think, which is Russia believes that the international system is inherently becoming multipolar, as they call it, polycentric, whatever word you want to use. And their view is, okay, there are two options. And they, as Vladimir Putin has said this before many times, either there are no rules and there are only deals, okay? Or there are rules like there were 70-plus years ago, okay? Which is, we are a great power. The rules that apply to little people don't apply to us. We have the rules that we had throughout the 18th century, you know, late 19th century. These are the rules of the international system, okay? We have our sphere of influence. We dominate our region, okay? Our interests are priorities, and the rules that apply to most countries don't apply to us. I think that's the Russian perception. And essentially what they put out 2 years ago as a result of confrontation said, look, either these will be the rules, we're going to go back to 19th century rules, or there are no rules.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting. I also like to first let's get Johan in here on this before I move on.
I think the overall aim for the current Russian political leadership is staying in power. I mean, let's not forget what's happening back in Russia at the moment. It's about selling national greatness when you can't deliver economic growth in this sort of deal with a population of less freedom and accepting certain streaks of authoritarianism in Russia. The government seems to be generally concerned about its own security back home, looking at creation of Rosgvardia, concentrating the ability to use military force, etc. So this of projecting greatness from the outside, you know, comparing the TV and what you see on the TV,
TV when and the
you
refrigerator.
Look in the fridge. This goes, you can only go so far with this. But let's not forget that perspective, what happens in Russia as well at the same time. Because it's very easy to do this sort of geopolitical discussions based on countries as just entities, not looking inside.
No, I mean, I tend to be skeptical of the notion that this is all for domestic consumption, though. I tend to agree with Mark Galeotti that Russia's made an ideological turn. It's made an ideological turn, and the ideological project is this Russia as a great power project. And this I think is becoming the most important thing right now, more important even than stealing.
I'm not saying it's only for domestic consumption, but I mean, let's keep that in mind, that that dimension exists too.
Now, there's one thing I wanted to bringing Mark into the discussion, because we all really wish Mark were here, but he's off at a speaking engagement in Warsaw. I hope he's listening. Mark's made the point on this podcast that if Russia gets, Michael, what you say he wants, basically a world with no rules, or one of the things he might want, the alternative thing, this is bad for Russia, because Russia's actually would be weak. And if everybody started playing by no rules, then Russia would be in a very bad position. Their strength now is that we're all playing by rules. The West is playing by rules. Russia is not. That gives them an asymmetrical advantage. If we all started playing like this, if we all started behaving like a rogue state, if we were truly going to party like it's 1815, you know, Russia wouldn't do well in that world, would they? Given their current capabilities.
Well, okay. I had this kind of intellectual, I think, argument a little bit with Bobolo in his book, Russia and New World Disorder, where he essentially posited this argument that the world's transitioning to disorder and that's bad for Russia. And I came back to him and I said, well, a country that actually believes in the sort of Leviathan Darwinian world and has geared itself towards this, really leverages just use of military power for coercion and whatnot, actually is better set up to, at least in the interim, live in a sort of universe than the rest of us who think that great power status is based on the economic foundation of power and innovation, and we're in this magical 21st century where people don't take territory from their neighbors and don't use force for coercion. So on the one hand, yeah, I agree, it's a problematic world for Russia. On the other hand, I think the Russian belief is, look, we did okay in the 18th century, all right? We're kind of that national, I mean, how do we get to this world? We did okay in the 18th, 19th century. We can probably manage it through. The important thing for Russia is that, look, it has big disadvantages in any multipolar world order where it's got the United States on one end and China on the other, right? It's clearly a much weaker country relative to those two. But in its near abroad, Russia's definitely stronger than everybody else around there, right? So I think from their perspective is they could carve out their own sphere of influence and they could become this some kind of junior great power in a non-rules-based international system. But I take your point that it could all be fantastical. And the reality is that both Russia and China today are actually very scared that the United States will step away too quickly from the Middle East, will step away too quickly from Afghanistan, and that all these countries who have aspirations to be powers and power brokers, they actually don't want to have responsibility for any of this stuff.
Yeah. No, a Russian foreign ministry official, who I will not name because you're speaking in confidence, said this exact same thing to me. His greatest fear, and I think he was reflecting the opinion of a lot of people inside the Russian foreign policy establishment, is that the United States would step back and leave a vacuum, and that would be bad. Johan, your thoughts on this?
Well, coming from a small country near Russia, this is a very unappealing prospect. A no-rule-based world will be bad for everyone, including Russia.
I have no
thoughts on that, but I can just leave it at that.
Okay, all right. Now, one more thing before we move on to the second half, as I wanted to touch on, and this is that Russia's mixing non-kinetic and kinetic methods in its strategy. And do you see this mixture as a temporary compensation for military weakness vis-a-vis the West as Russia catches up, or is this the wave of the future?
No, I don't think so. And I'll be frank. I think in actual likely conflicts, as opposed to on paper, one thing I understand, Russia's militarily weak versus the West on paper. But as I often say, Excel spreadsheets don't fight, okay? All right? In a battle between two Excel spreadsheets, we would really beat them. In a battle over Ukraine or the Baltics or whatnot, if it lasted 2 weeks, they'd probably beat us, all right? I'm just being frank about that. So our power really peters out as we get towards Russia borders. And keep in mind, Russians always like to fight across the street, whereas the United States typically plays away games. And that gives them a lot of options. So is it a compensation for weakness? No. What it is a genuine Russian realization that, look, we have pretty credible conventional force, okay? All right? But they're cognizant of their limitations, okay? They're cognizant of vision sustainability. And most importantly, they understand, look, the United States is a pretty powerful adversary. The West is. And even though decision-making here is slow, if you get yourself out there and you get stuck, it gives the United States the opportunity to catch up and contest you, right? You have to keep being ahead, setting the agenda, and always making the United States and the West react too. And the way you do that is you primarily achieve your political ends on the cheap through asymmetric and indirect means, and you bring force in for coercive effect. Basically, you run across the transom, you punch your adversaries in the face with your fist, and then you withdraw so you don't get stuck out there, okay? And that's essentially the way Russia's been acting both in Syria and in Ukraine. Rotate forces in. As soon as you don't need them, rotate them out. Now you see me, now you don't.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, one line from your piece that gave me absolute chills is when you said Russia is Apple and the West is IBM. And caused me to lose some sleep. Johan, last word to you before we move on to the second half.
I agree. Russia isn't militarily weak. I think that's an idea that still lingers on in analytical and policy communities here in the West. My basic question, who gets three brigades into the Baltic states first? That's for one. And I don't think Russia... I'm not so worried about the non-kinetic methods. I'm more worried about Russia's kinetic methods, and we see them being applied.
I'm worried about both.
I mean, Syria, for heaven's sake, it's very kinetic. And so is Donbass. And I agree with Michael's point that in the West, we have to solve everything by committee. Yes, we're stronger on paper, but it's 28 or something like that states that has to respond. Russia has one chain of command.
One person.
One person. Yeah, but it's one chain of command and not 28.
Yeah.
You just map that up.
But even if it was one chain of command against one chain of command, it is the, as Michael makes the point in his piece, the institutionally, Russia is much faster than we are. And I mean, I wouldn't want to change that because I kind of like our democracy, right? But
I want to do something. I think Michael made a good point that needs to be emphasized, that speed would matter. Speed and decisiveness and initiative. While we are still thinking and sort of tying our boots, basically, it's all done.
Right.
So, and we don't have a time. We have to prepare for quick action on Russia's side when they decide to do things.
Right.
And that's another thing we should bear in mind.
Well, your question about who can get three brigades into the Baltics quicker is a very good segue for our second half. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion, narrow the aperture, and zero in on one part of Russia's neighborhood that really keeps NATO strategists up at night. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. is military analyst Michael Kaufman, a senior fellow at the Wilson Center's Kennan Institute and a research scientist at the CNA Corporation. Also joining us via Skype from New York is Johan Norberg, a senior research analyst at the Swedish Defense Research Agency. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Прибалтийские страны поддерживают...
В Прибалтику, прямо к границам России. Вот почему?
В каких обстоятельствах Россия вообще может напасть на Литву?
Очередное размещение войск на границе
For years... A Russian attack on the Baltic states has been one of NATO's worst nightmares because it would force the choice of a war with a nuclear-armed Russia or the complete discrediting of the alliance's collective security guarantee. But due to geography and Russia's area access, area denial capabilities, it is broadly assumed that it would be very difficult, if not impossible, for the West to defend against a Russian attack. And for that reason, NATO has settled on a strategy of deterrence, putting thousands of troops in the Baltics, not enough to stop a Russian invasion by a long shot, but enough to make them think twice about the political costs. Michael, I know you have very strong opinions about this, very strong opinions about deterrence in the Balkans, which you've written about extensively. So have at it here.
Well, I think that the problem of deterrence in the Baltics is a pretty serious one, but I definitely have challenged some of the conversation that they've been going on in Western and NATO circles over the last 2 years of it. So here's kind of setting the perspective on this. And one, look, the reality is, all right, that by virtue of breathing, living, and existing, okay, Russia can invade and seize the Baltics any day of the week. And this has been true. This is not like a new discovery. You know, as always, the defense establishment in the last years has been like Christopher Columbus. It has landed on the Russian military and discovered, my God, they have an army and an air force. How long have they had all these things over there, right? They could have done this since day one when we invited the Baltics to join NATO, right? This has basically always been the case to maybe a lesser extent, but the reality of the military balance in the Baltic region is such that Russia has substantial conventional dominance. All right, two, we should also understand that, look, in all cases, a Russian sort of invasion of Baltics is a very low probability event. One of the ways we know that they don't want to do it is the fact that, A, they could do it any day, they haven't done it. B, they seem to very keenly invade countries that they don't want to join NATO, right? Like Ukraine and Georgia. And why do they do that? If you don't believe in NATO guarantees, if a country joining NATO is not important to you, you don't value those commitments from the United States, then why do you work so hard to keep countries out of NATO? Why do you invade Ukraine to keep out of NATO if you don't value NATO membership, right? So clearly the Russians really believe in this guarantee, and both in Russian leaders and Soviet leaders never once raised the issue of NATO alliance commitments. So, but I think that there's a real concern about these more indirect asymmetric approaches, which are often sort of lesser considered cases for the Baltic fight.
Mm-hmm.
But they're the most probable ones. And as you sort of see, as I described it, that, look, Russia's not going to put itself out there, okay, with deploying conventional military force for which it will not have a good exit strategy. It will not have plausible deniability. It will not have basically be able to carve out a space for it where it can cheaply make political gains and pursue an emergent strategy. Deploying heavy conventional force is not an emergent strategy. Once you do it, it's very hard to back out of it. All right. And it really cuts off your options. And then it sort of throws at you, you know, your core, your limitations, your constraints. Russia doesn't have much manpower, actually. Mm-hmm. Entire Russian land force is maybe a little over 300,000 strong. Force generate maybe 50,000 troops. Sure. Could easily take the Baltics, square up against NATO. Who's going to occupy the Baltics? Where are they going to find the manpower for that? You see why they only took a tiny piece of the Donbass, half the Donbass in Ukraine? No people. One, no operational reserve. Real sustainability issues if this was to be a long, protracted fight. So there's a lot of problems that I think they're very cognizant of in Moscow, and that's why they would never put themselves out there, right? A much more likely case if they do anything is like Crimea. Deploy military power to threaten, intimidate, and coerce, and then use a more indirect asymmetric approach to see what kind of political gains you can get. If they establish ever another formulaic interaction in the Baltics, like they've had with the United States in Crimea, in eastern Ukraine, and Syria, then I would frankly bet on them because they've done a very good job playing to our cognitive biases to get what they want.
So you would bet on kind of a little green man strategy in Narva or something along those lines?
Well, okay, so if we look at very rapid cycles of escalation in eastern Ukraine, it did not start with little green men. It started with basic political warfare, what Russians call mobilize the protest potential of the population, mm-hmm. right? And they do this all over the place. You saw them try to do it in Germany last year in January over the case with of this case, missing kidnapped girl, which was entirely made up. They just wanted to see how many people they could get out protesting. So probably, you know, your basic political warfare, unconventional warfare, the second thing they try in Ukraine, basically state-sponsored insurgency, right? Third thing they try in Ukraine was deploying conventional capability and mixing it in with a state-sponsored insurgency and some of their own special forces. So, I mean, there are a lot of options for them and iterative approaches they could try without doing the sort of Crimea, let's send in lots of special forces. Because if you send in special forces, we'll shoot the special forces.
Right. Now, what is what the West is doing in terms of defending the Baltics the right move, putting these tripwire forces in? And I'll go to you in a second, Johan, but would you agree with this strategy, or do you think the West should be doing something else?
So, okay, what the West is doing is not deterrence. It's classic assurance. So alliance politics and deterrence are two different problems in international relations to solve. But what the West basically did is they said, look, we don't really think this fight's going to happen. And deterrence is very, very expensive. How are we going to deter this Eurasian land power, all right, in the Baltics? If you look at the terrain and the geography, a lot of people don't like saying the Baltics are indefensible versus Russia. I like saying it because, one, it's true, and two, let's say it's not indefensible. Let's say it's very hard to win that fight. How about that? So what the West basically said, we will assure allies, okay, and we will sort of brand it as a deterrence thing. But actually, we're not doing conventional deterrence by denial. And in terms of deterrence by punishment, what you asked, Brian, about tripwire troops. So, well, we got half of it. So the concept of tripwire troops is that they're attached to something. And in the European theater during the Cold War, there were tripwire forces forward-based, right? But then behind them was a very large NATO army with American divisions that, if the wire was tripped, would then go to war and punish the Soviet Union, right? So today, we do have tripwire troops, but there's nothing behind them. And anybody can look at them and say, okay, so they have like one company in let's say, Lithuania of troops. So let's say we trip that wire. What are they going to do? Where are America's follow-on forces? What are NATO's follow-on forces in Germany? There aren't.
Well, let's just say an American or a German or a Brit or a Canadian gets killed in the Baltics, God forbid. That would have consequences. There would be enormous pressure, and suddenly you're in a war with NATO, no?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right, and it's quite true. However, understanding this, that if Russia ever got to a point where it was willing to kill an American or a German soldier to achieve its objectives, right? We're going hypothetical.
Yeah, no, yeah, we are.
Never got to that point. I then asked myself, which deterrence theory does this whole tripwire thing align to? And the answer is neither and none. Okay? There is no chapter in Thomas Schelling's book, okay, Arms and Influence, that says that, you know, a 1 foot or a half foot fence is better than no fence. No. Either you're working towards deterrence by punishment, okay, and you've shown your adversary that you will credibly punish them and retaliate if they do something. or you don't have anything, because in a deterrence game, they don't give out participation trophies. Right. There's no, like, we tried and we got halfway there.
Right. Johan, I know you're dying to jump in here. I see you writing. Yeah, so it means you have something intelligent to say, I'm sure.
I mean, Russia can invade the Baltic states any day. And the tripwire is getting a little thicker now. And also, I mean, to quote Woody Allen, 80% of success is showing up.
We've never quoted Woody Allen on this program before. That's great.
Sorry?
We've never quoted Woody Allen on this program before. I'm happy. That's a first. That's good.
But I think the important signal now from NATO's side is not that this is finished by now. It is, but that there is an increase. We're slowly building what could be something. But I agree with Michael. Today, follow-on forces, etc., are very, very far away. And when it comes to NATO, I mean, it's always been very dependent on the U.S. commitment to NATO. Mm. The key resources have always been American and remain so to this very day, and even more so today. Which means that's why with the new administration, so many questions seem to be hanging in the air about that.
Right. Now, I want to stick with you here, Johan, on the next point I want to go to, and that's that many have argued that bringing Sweden and Finland into NATO's planning, if not into the alliance itself, the so-called 28+2 formula that has been discussed for years and was discussed at length in Warsaw, would significantly change the security equation in the Baltics. Now, I'm not a military expert. I listen to what other people are saying. I hear people saying this. Is this true? Would bringing Sweden and Finland, if not formally into NATO, de facto into the defense architecture of this region, how much would it change the equation?
I mean, I think it would. Looking at the sort of just the geography and the military chessboard in Northern Europe, thinking about a possible NATO operation, having easier access from the West would facilitate anything that you would need for an operation, not just more forces, but logistics, bases, et cetera, facilitate intelligence gathering, et cetera. So, of course, that would change the military equation overall. I think from the Russian side, though, I have a feeling that the Russians already consider Sweden and Finland as very Western, if not formal members of NATO, then at least clearly part of the Western bloc, where EU members, etc. So, and you know, Swedish and Finnish forces exercise with NATO forces regularly, etc., etc. So it is a bit unclear, but yeah. I think if Sweden and Finland would join, that would of course change things. But the key again in NATO would be the United States.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're seeing some movement towards this. I mean, you Sweden just signed this defense pact with NATO. We're seeing the Swedish officials sitting on NATO council meetings and Finnish members sitting on, which in the past it was only members on the NATO council. Now Sweden and Finland are present, which is a significant change that happened in Warsaw. Michael, I see you're shaking your head, which tells me you're skeptical.
Okay, so first, I agree with Johan's point, but the Russians have quite publicly stated that they don't see Sweden and Finland as neutral. They're not part of NATO, but they understand that in some kind of hypothetical war that Finland and Sweden would support NATO at the very least by providing them their territory for basing. And they have signed sort of support, religious support agreements. That's part one. Two, we should really be careful when we say Sweden and Finland. There's a very big difference between inviting those two countries into NATO. Inviting Sweden into NATO changes very little to nothing in the military balance, okay? Or in sort of Russian perceptions of how the fight shapes up. And I don't think it actually adds that much either, because Sweden would probably provide its territory to NATO to fight anyway. So it's sort of a legal change at best. But Finland's a really big difference to me. That, at least the way things are right now, is probably a terrible idea. And I'll tell you why. So I don't logically understand the concept of, you can't defend a tiny piece of real estate, so you're going to invite a country with a 1,500-kilometer border with Russia, none of which you can defend, and nobody has the manpower to defend this. And your plan is, you know, I'm in strategic debt. Like, I have a deficit, all right? That's very obvious to a revisionist power, and I'm going to withdraw a ton more money, and I'm going to add to my debt as somehow a way to get out of it. That's a terrible idea. I'll tell you why. U.S. force structure size is not increasing, okay? Everybody can measure it. U.S. alliance network keeps expanding. That's called heading towards strategic insolvency, and then eventually the whole thing becomes a deck of cards. I'm speaking from an American perspective, not the perspective of somebody living in the Baltics, right? So from that view, the last thing you want to do is taking a country whose border you have absolutely no means of defending. You have zero credibility that you could actually, in a fight, defend Finland against Russia, and think that this is somehow going to add to your credibility. No, on the contrary. Plus, I'll be honest, the surest way to kill NATO is to keep expanding it and turning it into the United Nations.
Johan?
I can see your point from an American point of view, but Finland isn't empty. It's not sort of, it is a country there, it has its own forces. And the main point of this is also, it's political. I mean, countries should be able to choose their foreign and security policy. I'll leave it at that. Yeah.
Michael, in terms of the defense of the Baltics, does bringing Sweden and Finland there change the equation at all?
No, I mean, I don't seriously see it that way, just because the reality is they would support NATO anyway, one, two. But the important, Johan's right, it's about politics, but the question wasn't about politics, right? The question was, how does it change the military balance to fight? Would it help or would it hurt? Another part of it is, look, isn't part of NATO's problem that they figured out in the last years that they've kept expanding as a political alliance? Now Russia has forced them intentionally to rationalize themselves as an actual defensive military alliance. And what have we found? A, there's not much military in NATO. B, they never had plans to be a defensive alliance or defend the Baltics. C, we got pretty big strategic insolvency issues because of that now. Things that people should have thought real hard about 15 years ago when they were expanding NATO. Now we can at least do it more thoughtfully, not say, well, you know, it's about politics. Everyone who wants to join NATO, they can join NATO, and then the consequences, America will deal with them because, you know, their power is indispensable, and we will just basically write checks that keep going to America's bank account.
Go ahead, Johan, and I actually want to go with you with another question.
I mean, this talk about NATO, in NATO's problems and weaknesses are, in a sense, Russia's opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, this has long been the case.
Given that we talked earlier about world reshaping, rules, no rules, my personal worry is that it might be tempting to test how far into insolvency, whatever you want to call it, from the Russian side. Right now it seems like we're talking about the Baltic states, etc., as high end, leaving Michael's strategy of low ambition, fail fast, etc., etc. But if this insolvency goes on and all the problems retain, the question can move into it. Actually, is doable with the light approach that Michael suggested. That's my worry, that the whole perception of the of NATO can move in the Russian mind on this.
Now, I wrote as we were talking in the earlier part of this discussion, though, I wrote down intent, because so much here depends on Russia's intent. As Michael pointed out earlier, if Russia wanted to take this little piece of real estate, it could very quickly take this little piece of real estate. Johan, you pay close attention to Russian force posture. What does the Russian force posture in the Baltic region tell you about Russia's intent?
The point is not Russia's force posture, because then you stare yourself blind onto what they have there in peacetime. Mm-hmm. That is important, of course, but for wars and operations, it is what you can move into theater in what time frames. I mean, they didn't have any force posture in Syria apart from a little base on the Mediterranean. And now an air operation going for 2 years. So when we look at Russian exercises, it's what they can move into an operation.
Okay.
Without a problem, 150,000 soldiers in a combined operation with Army, Air Force, and Navy. That is quite sizable. And you can probably do two of those at the same time if you look at all the assets they have. I don't agree with Michael's manning problem for the Russian armed forces. I mean, they seem to be pretty confident that they have decent manning levels as well, at least.
Uh-huh. Michael, any thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, okay, so this is a pretty common, like, minor point of difference between me and Johan. We have this discussion, I think, all the time.
And now you're having it live on the air.
Yeah, it's important for Russian military analysts to, you know, have different views, because otherwise you could say, oh, these two guys say the same thing, so we only need one of them. We can find efficiencies. Here's my view. I think Johan's absolutely right in what he said about sort of Russian military capabilities. You know, they can deploy these forces in the Baltics and get there faster, and they have the manpower to deploy for a fight. However, There are a couple important points here. So I do think it's very unfair to say, well, we can't divine intent. We cannot look at Russian force posture, Russian force mobilization, and discern what kind of fights they're planning for and what adversaries they do for. No, that is 100% the job of Russian military analysis. If you can't do that, then why are we here, right? And my view is one, Russian military modernization clearly showed a concentration and focus on the southern military districts and on the southern part of the western military district oriented around Ukraine and Crimea, and has only been slowly creeping its way up to the Baltics as sort of the last horse to cross the finish line. Two, we saw last year, Russian modernization and force readiness around the Baltic region is probably the worst in the entire Russian military. And remember when they fired the entire Baltic command and the ground force command last June? Yeah, that's an amazing invasion force they have there, right? And what did they fire them for? Poor readiness, terrible results in exercises, corruption, right? And then we look at overall Russian force posture and we see where Russia is concentrating forces, where it's busily building garrisons around Ukraine, where it's creating new divisions. Almost none of this is in the Baltics. Of course, it can get there, right? But look, Russia's 1/8 the Earth's landmass, okay, largest country. It has a pretty small army. It has the smallest army it's probably had in centuries to defend that landmass. So where Russians place their forces is pretty important. And where they choose to invest in modernization tells you a little bit about where they plan to fight, because they can't do it everywhere. And they don't have the money. So when we look at it, we say, okay, if the Baltics were a priority fight for them, they're doing a very awful and terrible job of signaling that, both to us and to themselves. Okay? At least that's my perception.
Johan, I know you disagree because I'm watching you.
I'll just leave intentions, because at the end of the day, it's very hard to figure out Russian intentions as we would like to know them. But looking at capabilities, they can move things around. And you know, look at a map, look where the Russian railways go. If you want to make major military operations, have the preconditions for that, moving forces, moving logistics, etc., follow the railways. And the Russian Gorg railway network goes all through the Baltic states, former Tsarist Russia, and through Finland. So the preconditions for having a Russian operation and the logistics you need are clearly better there than elsewhere. And forces are movable, and they will move them to where they need them. I know it's a great territory, and they always feel they have too little, but they will always move forces to where they will need them, not where they are trained, because that's partly also where you have the infrastructure for it. And most of Russia's populations live west of the Urals, and traditionally it was where it had a lot of training areas, and why build new ones when you already have them? So that's why much is actually centered west of the Urals. It's also where you have the communication networks. And then actually looking at the railways, west of the Urals is like a spider web. East of the Urals is usually two lines going east-west. So the possibilities of moving things around in the west are much greater, much more opportunities. I know Michael is skeptical of this
Michael looks skeptical of this argument. Give him one more chance to rebut before I move on to my final thing I wanted to hit on.
Okay. No, I'm not going to rebut. Everything Johan says is true. They can do it. All the railways are there because that's where Russia's population lives, right? That's the concentration of both Russia's population and that was where population of the Soviet Union lived. So, yes, it's all possible. But we have to ask ourselves, what are Russia's main contingencies and what is it positioning its force and where is it modernizing its force to fight? Where is it plan to intervene? And if we are honest and we look back at Russian military reforms, we'll say that in 2009, Russia took major units that were all in Western military districts towards Ukraine-Belarus borders. It knocked them all down and moved half of them way back into the central military district and the rest into the Caucasus. And they said, listen, we're never going to have a fight here on the border. Crazy, right? Why would we ever have a fight on Ukraine's border? Why would we fight the West here? And then when Ukraine came up, they immediately said, oh, God, we don't have any permanent units based on Ukraine's borders and we plan to invade Ukraine. This is a bad idea. And they moved, literally took all the things they did in 2009 and reversed them for all the stuff back on Ukraine's border. And now you can see a gigantic concentration of force from Crimea around Ukraine's southern eastern tip all the way to the top between Ukraine and Belarus concentrating units, right? But because of that, so this is like the good news and the bad news. The good news for NATO and the Baltics is it created a giant sucking sound on Russian manpower and on availability of units to set up these units and garrisons. It's pretty bad news for Ukraine. And the long-term bad news is, yeah, they're heavily building a railroad that goes around Ukraine now One thing Johan didn't mention is that part of the problem with that rail network is that it's supposed to go through Ukraine. and eventually they'll have the logistical capability to take all the stuff and throw it into the Baltics down the line.
Now, so, okay, I guess we're going to have, we will agree to disagree on this one. This was fascinating for me. The final thing I wanted to hit on before we go is Russia's A2AD capabilities. I saw a presentation in Tartu last year about Russia's A2AD that absolutely terrified me. It absolutely terrified me, because if you look at this on the surface, and I'm a layman here, I'm not a military analyst. I looked at this and I'm like, oh my God, we're screwed. We can't do anything. Michael, are Russia's A2AD capabilities in this region all they are cracked up to be, or is there a lot of alarmism out there about this?
All right. So yes and no. So the first problem with Russian A2AD capabilities, the way they're typically portrayed, is that they're all portrayed as sort of angry circles, right? People release these newspaper articles and they draw these big red angry circles. Yep. Like, oh my God, look at all the circles they have. And it seems very scary and frightening. So first of all, that's not a good way to think about it. And one, most of these articles are actually wrong on the circles and the ranges. Second, a lot of it doesn't work that way, I'll be frank. They just sort of, it's a very simplistic way of talking about area denial anti-access capabilities. Third, there are a lot of nuances there. So the honest answer is yes, they can impose very serious costs in a high-end conflict. Okay. No, they are not some kind of bubble of vulnerability that the United States can penetrate. In fact, you will find a real big problem in the conversation, which is actually most people discussing this problem have no idea what the U.S. military can or can't do, right? So this is sort of a one-sided conversation where, look, they have this surface-to-air missile system, or they have this anti-ship missile system, which can draw a big red circle. But most people don't actually know what the interaction with the fight would look like with the United States, and so there are a lot of assumptions made. I'll summarize it by saying the A2AD capability is pretty real. One, two, Soviet Union was always a leader in it, so this isn't like something that just happened in the last couple of years, right? What's happened was most of the weapons you see today were things the Soviet Union was developing in the late 1980s. Unfortunately, it expired, well, very fortunately, but unfortunately for the Russian military, it expired at the peak of its technological might. So the Russian military was left for 20 years without all the weapons it hoped to get in the 90s. And now these sort of evil children that are still, believe it or not, still technological children of the Soviet Union, they've appeared and they've been deployed throughout the Russian force. They're the new generation. And we have to deal with them. And what happened in the West is the West, when the Soviet Union collapsed, said, listen, we don't need to invest in these technologies anymore. We're going to go fight Taliban, Al-Qaeda, do counterterrorism, counterterrorism. So we did not invest in a lot. That's a bit categorical, but in some ways we did not invest in our next generation system because there was no 1990s, 2000 Soviet Union for us to fight, right? Whereas Russia, on the other hand, finally finished off these systems from the 80s and 90s and has deployed them throughout the force. So, yeah, they're pretty nasty, and we have to live with them.
Johan, last word to you about A2AD.
Thank you. Yes, I mean, I agree with much of what Michael said. But also, we don't know. They haven't been tested against an adversary that can affect them. So, I mean, the proof will be in the pudding.
Right, right. No, I was gonna say these when I every time I see a presentation in A2AD, I lose sleep that night. And now maybe I'll get a little bit more.
But also
sleep.
All these standoff warfare systems or air defense or what have you, I mean, they're never better than your intel capabilities and your targeting capabilities and your radars, etc. It's easy to just think how far does the missile fly, but that is making life too easy. Right. Are they integrated in a well-working command and control system that you actually shoot at the right things at the right time? There's not just, I mean, if you just fire a missile, you can just shoot down anything out of the sky.
Right.
And you don't want that. I mean, that can have, I mean, as we have seen, it has dire consequences if you do it carelessly.
Right. Okay, well, on that note, that's a good point to wrap it all up. We're bumping up against the clock. That's all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. has been military analyst Michael Kaufman, a fellow at the Wilson Center's Cannon Institute and a research scientist at the CNA Corporation. Also joining us via Skype from New York City has been Johan Norberg, a senior research analyst at the Swedish Defense Research Agency. Thank you, gentlemen, for what has been a very enlightening discussion.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.